Turning, if you will, back to the book of Job, couldn't help but think, while James was leading Seek Ye First a moment ago, if you ever went to Florida College, especially in my day, I'm not sure, Hannah, how it is now, but at least in my day, when you had all of the devotions and so forth, Seek Ye First was a song that we sang quite a bit. I never heard the song before I went down there. And I'm always immediately carried back, especially to Sutton Hall, and being a young guy. In fact, you can see a picture of me at that time singing probably that very song on Facebook. But nonetheless, I'm always immediately carried back there. And I say all that to say this. I was thinking, especially as I studied Job this week in preparing for this lesson, I remember going back all those years, and someone suggested that I might bring some lessons from the book of Job, 30 plus years ago. And I went to the book of Job and I read in it, and I decided that I wasn't anywhere near capable or at the point of attempting the book of Job. So I went to something much easier and put it off to a later time. And after thousands upon thousands of hours of study later, I'm still not sure I'm at the point of being able to understand the book of Job. It's a deep book, to be sure. If we went back, and by the way, there are outlines out on the table. I hope that you got a chance to get one. But if we went back and kind of recapped what we've looked at so far to bring us up where we are tonight, we come to kind of an apex or a crux or whatever in the book, climax, whatever. I think we've seen that Job was a good guy, maybe the best of people. I think that's easy to see. I believe it is also easy to see, though there would be plenty of people, I guess, who would disagree with me. Maybe not from here, but plenty would. But I believe that Job had, as good as he was, some underlying flaws or faults, or whatever you want to call them, that would have, without God's intervention, without his providential help here, would have destroyed him, would have caused him perhaps to be lost. In fact, we might just list them. Get the PowerPoint. I'll go put it up here. He was a good guy, but he had some underlying faults. I think we also see that God uses this test. Satan prods God, pushes God, challenges God. And this test is brought to Job. And God uses it to expose those flaws, those faults to Job. To teach Job, to perfect Job, to bring Job to where he needs to be. Now, to be sure, as you look at it, Job struggles with what happens. Doesn't understand it. Maybe none of us would. Maybe none of us could. And he doesn't understand it. We focused on the struggle. It may have seemed, as I was going through and focusing on the struggle, that I was saying Job is not a good guy. That's not true. I've tried to emphasize numerous times, I believe Job was good. He was the best there was. But the best of human beings have faults. No one is perfect. It doesn't matter if you're talking about the apostles or if you're talking about Job or any of the prophets or who you might be talking about today. The best of the best have faults. He's human. He's understandably messed up by what's going on. I think Ed used the term, maybe the best description of it. He's traumatized by what is going on. And you can see that as he struggles with all of it. But his goodness, what is good about Job, shines through. There are statements that he makes in the book. I'll emphasize those in tonight's lesson again. But there are statements that he makes that lets you know that there is good about him, that he is still a righteous man, even though he is struggling so. In the end, Job is a better man for what he goes through. You see that. The endurance of Job shows that he is a better person for it, even though his faults are exposed. Finally, he is rebuked by God. We'll talk about that tonight, for his faults. But ultimately, we see Job being and coming out of this, being perfected by God, being better for it. And maybe that's a description, as we look at all of those stages, Maybe that's just a description of life. Maybe that's what life is all about, especially for a righteous person as God deals with them and as they ultimately have to deal with God. Now, as we turn in the book and look in, I'd like for you to turn back to chapter 11. As we look at some of these questions that are raised, and I'm going to choose three of the speakers, Zophar first, in chapter 11 and down in verse 7, there is this question posed. I won't read all of this again here, but notice verse 7. Can you by searching find out God? It's a rhetorical question, Zophar is asking, and the answer to it is no. No matter how much we search in this life, if God gives us 100 years, if God were still giving 900 plus years, as to Adam and Methuselah and so forth, we could still not find out God. Can a man by searching find out God? Can he find out the Almighty, notice, unto perfection? The idea in today's language is, can you know everything there is to know about it? No. So it leads us to ponder the question, how reachable is God? I'm not, and never have taken, the deist position that God is impersonal. He's just kind of out there. He created the world, wound it up like a clock, and let it start ticking. I don't believe that. I believe God is a personal God, and the Bible is His communication with us. But if we are to understand God as infinite, eternal, and all that those words convey, then we do not have, in our finite being, we don't have the ability to understand God. And the truth is, we can only reach God or know God or find out God to the extent that God has revealed Himself to us. Which means there are plenty of things we won't know. The secret things belong unto God, Deuteronomy 29. You might look at something Job says. Turn to chapter 21. After struggling through this for a while, as he has, going round and round with his friends, he comes to a point in chapter 21, if you look down at verse 22, he asks this question, shall any teach God knowledge? Now that's interesting, because Job has already said, and we'll reiterate the point, but he's already said, I would arrange an audience with God, and I would address God, and I would dispute with God. And yet here he is, and again, you know, when you're going through things like this, you say contradictory things. You contradict yourself. He's doing that here. Can you teach God, seeing He judges those that are high? In other words, the highest of the high are still judged by God. God still knows far more, infinitely more than they do. Notice again in chapter 23, as Job continues, if you look at verse 8, when he says, behold, I go forward, but he's not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. Verse 9, on the left hand, where does he work? But I cannot behold him. He hides himself on the right hand, that I cannot see him. In other words, the point is, no matter which way I turn, I can't perfectly know God or find God. Again, look at chapter 28, when he says it like this, down in verse 7. And I'm not going to read all of this. But when he goes on, when he begins to say, there is a path, notice verse 7, there is a path which no fowl or bird knows, and which the vulture's eye has not seen. In other words, he pictures the idea in his day. Notice, we can fly today. Obviously, people can fly. But in that day, no one could. And yet, he would picture like an eagle or a vulture or whatever, circling high above the earth, seeing a great amount of space that man down here on earth can't see. What he'll go on to say here is, still, you can't see what God sees. God only knows certain things. No price can buy. There's no price you can pay to gain that knowledge. No where you can find it, etc., etc. In fact, he comes to the point of saying later in this chapter, he comes to the point of saying the limit of man's understanding, that is, if you want to know the most there is to know about God, the limit of man's understanding is to fear the Lord and to depart from evil. And that's really profound. It's very much like Solomon says at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, after pondering and going all over the place with it, he will finally and ultimately say, really all that man is to keep the commandments of God. You can know the most, find out the most, by being faithful. Something Elihu said is fairly profound as well. Look with me at chapter 34. And if we listen to Elihu, now remember he's the younger of the group, but down in verse 21 he says it like this, speaking of God, obviously. For his eyes are upon, and notice the way he puts it, his eyes are upon the ways of man, and he seeth all his goings. Now to me, and if you remember way back when we started this, I said that perhaps hits at what all of this is about. God can look down into the heart of man, look deep within the mind of man, into the recesses of man's being. God can know what man cannot know. God can see what he can't see. Elihu says, God's eyes are upon the ways of man. He sees all his goings. There's no darkness nor shadow of death where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. He will not lay upon man more than right. Now that sounds just like 1 Corinthians 10. No temptation overtaken you, etc., etc. He'll not lay upon man more than right that he should enter into judgment with God. And really what he's saying there, and he's saying it to Job. Job, you can't contend with God. You can't contend with God because what would you say to God? God, this is not right. It's not just. Well, Job has as much as said that. But it has to be. Because God can look inside you and know more about you than you can know yourself. It's fairly profound here. Again, if you look at chapter 36 as we continue with Elihu's statements, look at 36 and verse 26 when Elihu says, Behold, God is great. And we do not know him. Neither can the number of his years be searched out. For he maketh small the drops of water, etc., etc. You can't know God, Job. You can't find out everything about God. You can't even fathom. I mean, we can talk about infinity. We can work with it on a piece of paper as a mathematician. But we cannot grasp it. Not really. I mean, if we say space is infinite, the universe is infinite, what does that mean? What's your point of reference for that? How do you really understand that? Well, someone says, infinity is like going round and round and round this ring, and you just go forever. What is that? I mean, I only think in terms of 100 times or 1,000 times or 10,000 times. I can't really grasp infinity. That's what Elihu is saying here. So when you begin to ponder God, the point of reference from God for God and understanding why God does what he does. And that's the point of the book. Why does God do what he does? To make you better. To do what's good and right for you. Can you understand it? No. Not unless you're God. You can question it, as Job does, but you must come to the point finally of saying, God knows best. Now that's not enough for many people. And I suppose the more you suffer, the more traumatized you are by what's going on, the more that will not be enough for you. And yet, it still has to be. It still has to be enough to say God knows best. And God understands what is best for you. It has to be. And I'm not saying that I can always accept that, or I perfectly accept that, or maybe any of us do. But it has to be, when it all is said and done, it has to be the answer. And it has to be what you're satisfied with as a Christian. When you look in the book, there are a number of things that you see throughout the book that indicate how much God knows and that God really has always said to man. And I think even if you go back, and I want you again to think in terms of the book, if it's the most ancient of books, about the most ancient of times and what man knew and what he didn't know. And there's a great question about that. And I'm going to throw it out there to you because I want you to bear it in mind. You know, man has gone round and round and round with Stonehenge. How did we get it? And you can watch a documentary every other week and they'll tell you perhaps how it came to be. Still, we haven't solved that. How did man build the pyramids? We don't know. How did man build, and I don't even remember the name for it, but go to the Incan and Mayan ruins and some of the things there that are far more obscure and far less people know about than the great pyramids of Egypt are even more astounding in their engineering. There's just no way these gigantic stones could get up these great mountains and build these structures. What I'm suggesting to you is this. People laugh at some of the things the Bible says. They laugh at the Tower of Babel. They laugh at Noah building the ark. And yet when people laugh, sometimes you want to say, well, okay, explain the pyramids. Well, it might be this and it might be that. Exactly. Perhaps there was a lot of knowledge in ancient times that man did know that we just take for granted and assume that he didn't know. That we know things, we know everything today, and once man knew nothing. I'm convinced that man knew a lot in antiquity, but I'm convinced that the things he knew is because God revealed them to him, by and large. Now, I say all of that to say this. In a day when, admittedly, in a day when superstition and myth and legend and fairy tales and, you know, fantastical explanations ruled the day, when people thought in terms of Atlas holding the world on his shoulders, or perhaps that it was suspended on the back of a great turtle, or if you sailed too far in one direction in the ocean, you'd fall off the edge. I mean, those were the ridiculous things that people believed. And we know that. But when you look at the Bible, beginning with the book of Job, and the book of Job is filled with things, but all through the prophets, throughout the Bible, there are statements of scientific fact. There's not great explanation. God isn't saying, let me tell you how it all works, but there are just true statements made. I mean, for example, when you read in Psalm 8, and as Matthew Maury once did a couple of hundred years ago, or not quite, but 150 plus years ago, when he heard his daughter reading the paths in the seas, and he began to contemplate ocean currents. Ocean currents are now understood. Once they were not. Recently, as far as history is concerned, they weren't. But God knew of ocean currents. And the truth is, when you look throughout the Bible, you see this kind of thing. Let me suggest a number of things in the book to you. The only way man knew them, and he knows them as facts. He doesn't understand them, I don't believe. He doesn't know how it all works. I'm not convinced that man understood all that. I'm not convinced necessarily he didn't understand some of these things better than we think he did. But nonetheless, there are statements made. For example, look at chapter 9 and verse 6. When God begins to talk about, or when here, Job reveals the fact that he's aware that there's been a shifting of the earth, notice the point, out of its place. And he goes on to talk about the pillars thereof tremble. Now, a lot of times people look at this passage and say, oh, well, he means earthquakes, the shifting of the earth. But he doesn't say a shifting of a part of the earth. He says the shifting of the earth out of its place. It's very similar, if you look at Hebrews 12 and verse 26, it's very similar to a statement made there, which makes reference probably back to the flood and how the whole earth was shifted out of its place. I've listened to believing scientists, that is, scientists who believe in God, talk about the fact that evidence mounts all of the time to tell us that, yes, there was a global flood, and when there was, the earth literally shifted several degrees. It shifted and changed everything about the climatology of the earth. It's just a statement of fact. And whether or not that's what it means, notice some of the other things that stand out. Look at chapter 9, if you're there, and verse 9. He names several constellations that are in the northern hemisphere. Arcturus and Orion and the Pleiades, things we can see at different times of the year in the heavens, if you have ever played around with astronomy. But notice he also mentions, and the chambers are the constellations of the south. Well, what does that mean? Well, the point is, if you understand constellations and charts of the skies, or if you look it up, what you'll find is that of all the named constellations and so forth, the majority of them are visible from the southern hemisphere, not from the north. You can visibly see at any given time some 35 plus constellations in the northern hemisphere. But if you were to go to Antarctica, you could see another 50 or so that you don't see here. That is clusters of stars that since have been named, etc. Now, the point of all of that is this. Job lived in the Northern Hemisphere. How does he know? In his day, how does he just know about the constellations of the South? Has he sailed to the South? Has he gone as far as Antarctica and seen them? Or has it just been revealed to them that it is there? Let me suggest a couple of other things that are interesting. Notice when it talks about the earth being round. In chapter 22 and verse 14, it speaks of the circle of the earth. Sometimes people will point out, and there have been all kinds of translations of this passage, well, it means the vault. But if you notice, even in your translations that say the vault of the earth or something like that in Job, usually, consistently, in Isaiah 40, when the same word is used, they'll just go ahead and put, because if you look at Isaiah 40, it's kind of ludicrous not to say it's a circle. They'll just go on and put the circle of the earth. How does Job know that? I mean, in his day and time, the prevailing view, at least we're told, the prevailing view was the earth is flat. Yet Job speaks, at the very least, of an arch in heaven, an arc in heaven, or whatever. I suggest to you also one of the most profound statements in chapter 26 and verses 7 and 8 is that God stretches out the north over the empty place and hangs the earth upon nothing. If you look at the Hebrew word that's used there for nothing, it means absolutely nothing. The earth spins on its own axis. We know that. We learn that in school, and we take it for granted that that's just something that little kids learn. For thousands of years, the majority of people were not taught that. They had some idea, something was there holding the earth up, but not God. God revealed that the earth literally is suspended in space upon, as we would look at it, nothing. There's no physical thing there. Obviously, there are the forces of nature, as we call them, holding it there. But there's no, physical thing that upon which the earth is suspended. Look at chapter 26 and verses 10 through 12 as he describes the boundaries of the seas and speaks of it in terms that God is in control, that God rules and decides the boundaries of the seas. I think about these passages, and there are a few of them sprinkled throughout the Psalms. Jeremiah even speaks of it. But I think about this when there's all of this conjecture that, the sea, the global warming is going to cause the seas to wash away half the United States or whatever, That may happen. It may happen. And God may decree that it happens. But if it happens, it will be a God's decree, not just strictly something that man does. God is speaking here in terms of His control. I'll tell you something else that's interesting in the book, too. It's just the whole idea of rain. Again, I learned this in grade school. You probably did as well. There's a cycle of water. The sun sucks up the water into the clouds, and the clouds rain it back down on earth. That's way oversimplifying. But in ancient times, they didn't really understand that. And yet, in chapter 36, Elihu explains it. I mean, just point by point. This is exactly what happens. And he gets it right. How do you know that is the point? How do you learn that? Or chapter 38 and verse 12. Notice where God causes the day spring to know its place. That is the break of day. Why do we have sunrise at 4 o'clock one part of the year and 7 o'clock another part of the year, etc.? Is it not because of what God has done as far as the earth's rotation, its revolution around the sun? And is that not what causes the different times, so to speak, of the daybreak and the sunset? And yet here, their understanding that it is God that has determined that, as though God is responsible for all of this that makes it be just as it is. Another profound question that's asked in the book is in chapter 38 and verse 19, and it's the whole knowledge of light. And it looks like a simple question, but if you look at the way it's worded, it's a very deep question about light. It's not just what is the source of light. It asks the question literally, from where does it dwell? Now that's an interesting question. And especially when you begin to consider, and I'm not going to get off into a tangent on this, but if you begin to consider the fact that God created light before He created the sources for light. You can go to Genesis 1 to check that out. But God created light, and then He created the sun and the stars and so forth that are the source of light. So from where does it dwell? Where did it come from? What are the sources of the light literally in heaven? The more we understand, I say we, the more people that are far more learned about that than I am, understand about light and how long it takes for it to travel and how vast the universe is and so forth and so on, the more astounding that question becomes. Yet here is an ancient individual, young individual, posing that and saying the answer is God knows. It's not as simple as some of the ridiculous stories that we're told in our day, Elihu could have said, but rather it has a more profound answer. Notice chapter 38 and verse 33. The very fact that there are laws of nature. You have to understand, this is thousands of years before Newton sat under the proverbial apple tree. And yet Job speaks of the laws of nature. There are laws of nature. We don't even understand all of that. Scientists are learning more of those laws of nature all the time. And yet here it is telling us from antiquity, there are laws of nature. And God is the one who governed them. Notice as God, even in His speech in chapter 40, speaks of the great behemoth and Leviathan. There's all kinds of conjecture. What is that? Is that the great dinosaur of the land, the behemoth, and the great dinosaurs of the sea, the Leviathan? It might be. Might not be. But what God says about it is, look at the greatest of beasts, the highest of the creation of the animals. Pick any trait you want to look at, the fastest, the most beautiful, etc., etc., etc. And what God is saying to Job is, I did that. It was my mind that created that. I designed those animals. If you're fascinated by animals and all the differences and all they do like I am, the more you look at all of that, you think of what kind of mind would it take to design all that, to create all of that. And God is basically saying to Job with all of this, if you know anything, Job, and you do. I mean, you know more than people, the majority of human beings who have ever lived. He knew more facts. I don't know if he understood any of them, but he knew the facts. And yet what God is saying is, if you know all of that and you do, where'd you get it? Who told you? And the truth is, the real question is, He's saying to Job, where were you when I did all of that? Now, as we go back and we begin to look at Job, we start asking questions about Job. We start asking the question, God rebuked Job. And I believe the book shows that. The Bible shows that explicitly when you look at the end of the book, chapter 40, for example, where God begins to speak from the whirlwind, the Lord rebuked Job. Now, we ask the question, why? What did Job do wrong? Was Job a bad guy? Well, we started, and I started tonight by saying Job was a good guy. He was the best of people. So what was it that Job did wrong? What were maybe those underlying flaws or faults that came out? Well, let's just consider some of the things he said. And this takes us back to the last couple of lessons. Look at some of these statements. Why was he rebuked? Chapter 7 and verse 20, when he said to God, Job speaking, what have I done to you, God? Why have you made me a target? You know, you're firing at me. Like we would say today, you got your gun pointed at me and you're just firing at me. Why are you doing this? Is it right for man to look at what happens to him as though God is firing at him like a target? Notice what he went on to say, chapter 13 and verse 3. I would arrange a time. Now this one is important. I would arrange a time to speak with God and key upon the word dispute there, because God is going to quote him when he rebukes him. I would arrange a time to speak with God and dispute with him what is happening to me. It's undeserved. It's not right. It shouldn't be happening. Chapter 19 and verse 7. I cry aloud to God, but there is no justice, no equity, nothing fair about all of this, as he said there. In chapter 30, when he said in verses 20 and 21, I cry unto you, speaking to God, and you don't hear me. Do we have a right to say that to God? I cry out to you, but you don't hear me? Maybe God has not answered. And maybe you prayed many times. But is it all right for me to say to God, you don't hear me? Or when he said to God, remember that Arabic term that he used for cruel there, like a victim who's attacked without mercy. You, God, are become cruel to me. And when you oppose me, you in fact oppose yourself, because I am your servant. I'm doing everything, or I was doing everything I could do to work for you, and yet you oppose me. Do we have a right to say that to God? You know, you beat me down, God, you take away the best servant you've got. That's what he's effectively saying to God. I'll suggest a couple of more things. Chapter 30, when he said in verses 23 to 25, I know the outcome. I know that you will let this go on and you will bring me to death in this condition. You will let it go on. And even I, a human being, had pity for people in similar situations who were in trouble. It's as if to say to God, I've been better than you. I've been more merciful than you. You let it go on. I wouldn't have done that. I would have stopped it before now. I know we feel that way sometimes, perhaps, but do we have a right to say that to God? In chapter 10 and verse 10, when he said to God, you poured me out like milk and curdled me like cheese. Or finally, when he said in chapter 10 and verses 18 and 19, there was no reason. Notice, not just I wish I hadn't been born. There was no reason for me to be born, just to be brought to this. It questions the whole providence of God. And when you look at statements like that, there isn't a wonder. Turn with me to chapter 40. There isn't a wonder why God just stops this abruptly and begins to speak. And if you look at chapter 40 and verse 1, moreover, the Lord answered Job. Now notice, they've all been speaking. But the first one called in question here is Job. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproveth God, let him answer it. And whatever translation you have there, if you're looking at that in verse 2, when he says, he that reproveth God, let him answer it, he quotes Job. Back when Job said, I would arrange an audience with God and I would dispute with God. Then God says to Job, if you dispute with me, then do it. You answer it. You would arrange an audience with me, you have it. You would dispute with me as if to say, God, this isn't fair, this isn't right, all of those things we've been quoting that he said, you have it. What would you say to me? What do you know that I don't know? And then he begins, he answers Job. There is no answer from Job. Job is just silent. He's humbled and he's silent in the presence of God. And the Lord answers him from the whirlwind and begins to say, and this is where he launches into just expounding to him very poetically, and very beautifully, he just begins to speak to Job of all the, you know, things further that Job does not understand. The point of all of this is, God comes to Job in this condition. But remember, saying all of these things, there still has been on the part of Job. And I pointed some of this out. We go back to chapter 9. We look at verse 28, a redeeming quality of Job. I'm afraid of my sorrows. I'm so full of grief. I'm so filled with sorrow over what's happened to me. It makes me afraid. Whenever a righteous person, traumatized or not, whenever a righteous person catches himself, and I think you do that, you hear things that are coming out of your mouth, you feel what you're feeling, and it bothers you. It's as if to say, did I just say that? Is that the way I really feel? I know I'm angry. I know I'm upset. I know I don't understand. But is that the way I really feel? Job is afraid of it. No, he doesn't understand. And yes, he's questioning all of it. And yes, he believes it's unfair. And he cannot find anything he's done that for which he deserves all of this. And yet he still, I know, I believe in God. And that's a redeeming quality in itself. When Job says, for example, as long as I live, I will believe in him. Even after all of that is said and done, as long as I live, I will believe in it.
Or when he finally says, turn back a few pages and let's read this again. In chapter 28, when he finally comes to the point in chapter 28 and down in verse 28 of saying, unto man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. The fear of the Lord. He's afraid of God. He's not the adamant atheist screaming in the face of a God that's not there. You know, we've seen that. We've seen how people angered at God, defiantly scream at God. You know, you have no right to do to me what you've done. You have no right to treat me the way you've treated me, etc. Just defiantly scream out at God. He's not doing that. Even as he gropes with trying to understand, he still maintains a reverence for God. And he said, if there is an answer, if there's wisdom to be found, it's found, notice verse 28, in the wisdom of God. And to depart from evil is understanding. If I'm to find an answer, I've got to get my mind right. My heart has to be right, or I will never understand it. Those are the good qualities in Job. Those are the things in Job that maintain, if you will, his integrity, even at his lowest point. And that's why when God comes to him and we see him, and go back again to chapter 40, I keep turning back and forth, but if we go back to chapter 40, that's why Job is silent. That's why when God speaks here, Job doesn't say anything. I mean, God says the very first thing out of God's mouth is, you wanted an audience with me? You have it. Speak. Answer it. I'll hear your points. No points to make. There's only humbling yourself before God. Finally, for the Christian, there is only coming to your knees and saying, God, you know. You know everything. You know right. You know what's best. I submit. Even when God finishes here and God, you know, enumerates, where were you when I did this? Where were you? And you can almost see Job just shaking. I wasn't there. I don't know. There's no question here that can be answered. There's no question here to which you can respond. There is nothing to say. And finally, Job will answer God in chapter 42. But listen to what he says. Chapter 42, Job answered the Lord, verse 1, and said this, verse 2. I know that you can do everything. I don't question that. I know you can do everything. I know you are God. And no thought can be withholden from you. Who is he that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not. In other words, what he says, I've spoken things I don't know. I don't understand. It's as much as saying I've been stupid. When I've lashed out and all of these kinds of things I've said, I didn't understand. I didn't know. I should not have said it. I've uttered what I don't understand, things too wonderful for me, verse 3, which I don't know. Here, I beseech or I beg you, and I will speak. I will demand, and the word demand here is, I would ask of you, is the way we would say it today. I would petition you for, and declare thou unto me. I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now, notice this phrase, but now my eye sees. I think what's comparable to that in our day is this. Maybe you've read a passage 1,000 times. And you go through something. And you see that passage again. And you've heard it 1,000 times. But now you really understand. Job said, I've heard, but now I see. And notice verse 6. And that's why I abhor myself. You look at all of these statements, you want to know how a righteous person feels when he goes through all of this and he struggles through all of this and he says all of this and feels all of this. How does a righteous person end up feeling? I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes. And thus Job repents and God forgives, obviously. Now the last lesson, God will turn to the three friends. And we'll take a look at the three friends in the book. We'll consider them, and then we'll consider how God deals with them, and we'll be done with the story. The story is a hard one. I started tonight by saying, you know, studying a long time now, trying to understand. Even so, you know, you feel inadequate with a book like this. There are so many lessons to learn. There's so many lessons to learn about yourself. Maybe the greatest of lessons is to learn
in the simplest of terms. Let God be God. You don't try to be, because you can't. If you're tonight and you're not a child of God, you believe in God, in all His wonderful majesty, in all His eternity. You don't understand all of that, but you believe in it. And tonight you would confess that Jesus is His Son, who gave His life for you. You repent of your sins. Humbled before God, you want to change whatever is wrong in your life and just do what's right. There's nothing to say. There's nothing to argue with God. You just want to do what's right. God will forgive you if you'll be baptized for forgiveness of your sins. And maybe you're here and you've been baptized and you look at your life and you say, my life has not been right. I'm like Job. I just need to humble myself before God and say, please forgive me. I abhor myself. Please forgive me. And God will. Because when all is said and done, God is a merciful God, a loving God. I mean, Job could have made him mad with all of that stuff if he were a different God. And God could have struck him dead if he were a different God. It's not what God wants. He wants to look into your heart and find good. He wants to save you. That's what it's all about.